The housing market, of course, remains very weak in many parts of the country, so some sellers are getting creative. NPR's Carolyn Beeler has more.
Bill Worthington calls himself a human prop. He seems more like an enthusiastic tour guide.
Look around the kitchen here. It's essentially a brand new kitchen with high-end appliances, brand new cabinetry.
Worthington is showing me his $1.5 million Princeton, New Jersey home, just like a proud owner would. But he doesn't own the place. He doesn't even know the owner. He just moved in, furnished and decorated the house, and he keeps it in perfect condition.
This is a daily chore. I get up, I gotta make the bed so it looks like that.
It looks like a bed in a hotel. Every morning he drags himself up.
Then it's simply a matter of straightening the bed, putting the decorative pillows back in place. I'm not a real good Susie homekeeper, so it takes me maybe 10 minutes of staggering around here half awake.
Worthington is a home manager, which he says means
living high on the hog for not a lot of money.
Worthington pays $1,500 a month to live in the house. In exchange for great digs at a relatively low price, Worthington keeps the house in perfect condition. It has to be ready to show prospective buyers at a moment's notice.
Toilet seats have to be down. No toothpaste or toothbrushes on the bathroom counter.
John and Carla Schaefitz run show homes in Princeton, New Jersey. They hired Worthington to live in the house, which had been on the market for 3 years before the owner called in extra help. Carla Schaefitz says the company operates under the assumption that lived-in houses sell for more than empty ones.
The prospective buyer will know that the house is vacant, because there is no food in the refrigerator, there's no clothes in the closets. So therefore, what happens is they will lowball offers because they feel that the owner might be struggling because they might have two mortgages.
Nationally, the franchise has about a third more homes in the system than this time last year. There aren't statistics on whether having someone live in a home makes it sell faster, but it is generally accepted that staging does help. Koki Adasi-Afuya is a realtor in Washington, D.C. He saw home staging increase when the housing market hit the skids.
I saw the big jump probably back in about 2007, 2008. Inventory, you know, kept increasing and people saw that it was getting harder to sell a house. So they started to think of other creative ways to make the property sell.
For many sellers, those ways include traditional staging and its newer cousin, virtual staging. A company will use a photo editing program like Photoshop to add furniture and decorations to images that can be posted online. The idea is to help buyers visualize what the house could look like if they moved in. But it's controversial. Walter Maloney is a spokesman for the National Association of Realtors.
It's fine to show window treatments and furniture in a room to kind of give it perspective. But if you go beyond that to the extent of, for example, photoshopping in a chandelier that isn't there or changing the exterior view from a building to trees, then that is misrepresentation.
Washington realtor Adasi-Afuya says some of his buyers use photo editing programs to help them picture how a new home would look furnished. But he doesn't recommend virtual staging for his sellers. Touched-up online houses can easily create disappointed house hunters when they see the real thing. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Mexico is slapping new tariffs on dozens of U.S. products this week. It's the latest move in a long-running battle over the U.S. government's refusal to let Mexican trucks travel beyond a narrow stretch of the border. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, the trade dispute presents a challenge for President Obama, who has set a goal of doubling exports within the next 5 years.
For the last decade and a half, Craig Hill has been one of the beneficiaries of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now, he could become one of its casualties. Hill is a hog farmer in Warren County, Iowa.
We're a family operation. My son and I and wife all participate in the labor here, and we've got about 1,600 pigs on feed and farm about 1,700 acres.
When Hill started farming in the late 1970s, nearly all American pork was sold domestically. Now, Hill says about a quarter is shipped to other countries, including jamon and carnitas sold in Mexico.
We depend a great deal on exports here in the U.S., and I think Mexico is one of our better customers.
So Hill is greatly concerned about the 5% pork tariff that Mexico announced today. Mexico took the action to protest America's failure to let Mexican trucks travel its roadways. Under NAFTA, Mexican trucks were supposed to have access years ago, but Congress has kept them out under pressure from the Teamsters Union. Although the few Mexican trucks that have been allowed in showed no unusual safety problems, Teamsters President James P. Hoffa insists they present a threat.
To let these truck drivers and trucks on our highways that do not meet our standards is to endanger the American driving public. That's why we're against it.
For years, Mexico patiently accepted the roadblocks. But when Congress canceled a pilot trucking program last year, the Mexican government had enough and imposed retaliatory tariffs. The additional tariffs announced today are designed to put more pressure on Congress. They're a setback for President Obama, who's made boosting exports a key part of his economic agenda.
Export growth leads to job growth and economic growth.
Labor expert Harley Shaken of the University of California at Berkeley says the widening trade dispute with Mexico puts Mr. Obama in a delicate position.
The president's got a real paradox here. He wants to double exports, and there is a lot of support for that, to be sure. But he also risks alienating labor, a key part of the Democratic base, on the eve of pivotal elections in November.
Opposition from organized labor could also be a stumbling block as the president tries to finalize a new free trade agreement with South Korea, something he says he wants to do by November. In the meantime, pork producers are not the only ones likely to pay a price for the trucking standoff. Mexico has attached tariffs of up to 20% on dozens of U.S. products, including sweet corn, chewing gum, and ketchup. Nick Giordano is with the National Pork Producers Council.
This takes a toll in terms of U.S. exports, U.S. jobs, and the way out of the box here is simply for the United States to come into compliance with its obligations under the NAFTA. This is what we want other countries to do. It's a two-way street.
U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk says the U.S. is committed to working with Mexico and members of Congress on a resolution that would satisfy both trade obligations and safety concerns. But trade experts say any resolution will get tougher the closer we get to the November elections. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
General Motors has begun the process of removing the U.S. government from its car business. Yesterday, GM filed papers with the Securities and Exchange Commission for an initial public stock offering, or IPO. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports.
The filing doesn't disclose how much stock will be sold, but many analysts believe the U.S. Treasury wants to sell enough to become just a minority owner of GM and raise $10 to $15 billion. That's a big IPO, and it won't be easy in this economy, says Joseph Schuster of IPOC Schuster. He says GM will woo big global investors first to encourage smaller investors to join in.
You line up the interest from funds which are flush with cash. I mean, especially in the Middle East nowadays.
Schuster's company plans to buy some of the stock, despite the risks. How much investors buy will depend on the price. Schuster says setting that price won't be easy. If it's cheap, the stock will be snapped up in a hurry. That's good, but
if it's too cheap, you know, the company itself and the government, you know, will leave a lot of money on the table.
The stock sale could happen by November. There will be plenty of number crunching between now and then to see if taxpayers will get their $43 billion of equity back. But remember the initial public offering. There will be more GM stock sold later, and it could take years for the government to sell off completely. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Rural hospitals across the country are struggling to keep their doors open. Voters in Modoc County in the remote northeastern corner of California will soon decide whether to tax themselves to save their local hospital. The county has gone broke trying to keep the hospital open, and that has led to a fractious debate in a proudly conservative frontier community. From member station KQED, Sarah Varney reports.
The hospital hallways here, like the nights, are quiet. It's been years since pregnant women could deliver their babies at Modoc Medical Center. A surgeon comes just twice a month to do simple procedures. Even the helicopter pad is sprouting weeds. But it's no exaggeration to say that the county hospital in Alturas, even with its limited services, is a lifeline to the people who live here. The closest full-service hospitals are hours away, and the nearby medical centers over the mountains are often unreachable during winter storms.
They gotta have something.
Vicki Smith moved here as a young girl. She's now 61 and owns the Main Street Family Diner.
There's a lot of retired people here, a lot of them. And if they don't have medical, they'll have to leave.
The talk of the diner and elsewhere in the remote Pitt River Valley is the fiscal calamity that could force the hospital to close and the county to go bankrupt. An outside audit found that county supervisors improperly used restricted funds to bail out the hospital, which was losing millions of dollars a year. Now, the county has to pay back some $12.5 million in federal and state grants, and the hospital is on its own to make ends meet.
It's almost living paycheck to paycheck, basically.
Monica Derner is the hospital's interim CEO, the seventh CEO in the last 4 years.
And some months are better than other months, and it's kind of just juggling the finances around to make it work right.
Somewhere along the way, a county supervisor uttered the unutterable, that the Modoc Medical Center just might have to close. The suggestion enraged residents here, especially those who came to Modoc with their Medicare cards to retire. A group formed to save the hospital. They held evening meetings and collected signatures. And now, at the end of this month, voters here will decide whether to increase their property taxes to fund their hospital.
Good afternoon. I'm Lou Miller with Save Our Hospital Committee. Uh-huh. And we have some information. And was
Lou Miller is a retired security guard who has the unenviable job of selling a tax hike here. Modoc is California's most Republican county, where ads for the local Tea Party run prominently in the weekly newspaper.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't.
Still, Miller says the one thing voters here hate more than taxes is the thought of being stranded in Alturas or on a ranch with no ambulance service and no place to spend the night when felled by pneumonia or a hip fracture. The hospital in Alturas, though, is not just a lifeline. It's an economic engine, even if it is just sputtering along. Like many rural hospitals, Modoc Medical Center is the largest employer in town, and people here worry what will happen if it closes.
We'll be reduced probably to one grocery store. We'll probably lose a hardware store. We'll lose a lot of things, and a lot of people can stay here.
Judy Mason is secretary of the Save Our Hospital Committee.
Then you get a reduced value of properties, so now your tax base is smaller also. So the county becomes even more impoverished.
Still, there's strong opposition to the tax measure. Doug Knox retired with his wife to a small ranch outside of Alturas. His driveway is lined with American and Confederate flags, and he is single-handedly leading the opposition to the parcel tax with radio and television ads.
If it costs me $10,000, $15,000, I'm willing to do it. Because I do not believe that throwing money at a problem is the way to go it and put it on the backs of the taxpayers.
But even the staunchly conservative county supervisors, who've come under fire for creating the crisis, admit the parcel tax may be the only choice. Dan Maxey is president of the Modoc County Board of Supervisors.
We're in a battle right now. We don't want to go insolvent. That's not going to resolve anything. If the county goes down, the hospital goes down. The hospital goes down, the city goes down. And we don't want to see that happening.
The battle over the hospital and allegations of impropriety have engaged people here in county government in a way not seen in decades. Attendance at public meetings is at an all-time high, and in dozens of interviews, residents say they're beginning to challenge the closed-door way county officials have long conducted business. Even the county supervisors admit the uncomfortable scrutiny may in the end be a blessing. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.